Welcome. This screencast completes a five-part series on concepts about SQL Server that all developers should know. I'm Jim O'Neill, a developer evangelist in Microsoft's Northeast District, and the material here is adapted from a Northeast Roadshow presentation I delivered in March 2009. Here are the topics I've covered so far: the SQL CLR, SQL Injection, Error Handling, and using SQL Server Profiler. If you missed one or more of them, you can catch them later. This presentation doesn't presume you've seen any of the others yet. The title of this session is Your Plans May Change, in which I'll provide an overview of execution plan generation and some insight into reading plans to help you tune your SQL. Let's start by examining how an execution plan comes into being, and then we'll look at some simple plans to get a feel for things that you as a developer want to look for when it comes to tuning performance for sluggish queries. It all starts with a query, likely one a bit more complex than this, but you get the idea. The text of the query is input to the query parser, the first part of what is known as the relational engine. The parser breaks the query down into its constituent keywords and parameters, confirms syntax, and performs some optimizations like flattening subqueries. Next, the output of the query parser, known as a query or sequence tree, along with database schema information and statistics, are passed to the query optimizer, which produces an execution plan, something like a blueprint for executing this particular query. The plan specifies how and in what order database tables and structures should be accessed to fulfill the query. The other bits of input involved here are what are called execution contexts. They store the information specific to individual instances of the query, while the execution plan for a given query exists only once. Execution plans are cached in what's known as the plan or procedure cache and reused when a new query is submitted that matches something in the cache, so the query optimizer will actually check first for an existing plan before generating a new one. One interesting thing to note about the process so far is that the relational engine has not actually looked at any of the data in the table to generate the plan. That's the realm of the storage engine, which works in tandem with the relational engine to respond to the query request. As the relational engine works through the execution plan, it requests row set data from the storage engine, which interoperates with SQL OS, the lowest level platform layer of SQL Server. It is possible at this point that the estimated execution plan is superseded by what's called an actual execution plan, since access to the real data may indicate that information that led to the original plan is no longer valid and a more efficient plan can be generated. To get the actual execution plan, then, the query has to be executed. Let's take a look at SQL Server Management Studio and a few queries using AdventureWorks to get a feel for execution plans, and a quick introduction into interpreting them. To get a visualization of the execution plan in SQL Server Management Studio, you just highlight the query to be analyzed and select Display Estimated Execution Plan from the context menu or toolbar. The shortcut is Ctrl-L. Under the covers, this executes your statements in the context of a set show plan XML on, so the statements don't actually execute. There's also a toggle in the menu and toolbar to compute the actual execution plan when you execute statements, since an actual execution plan requires that the statements be executed. If you have this option set, then when you execute a query, you'll see the Results tab, Messages tab, and Actual Execution Plan tab as a result. When doing so, your statements execute in the context of a set statistics XML on. I'll start with this simple query. When I generate the plan for this select, I get a new tab that shows how the query will be processed. The way to read these plans is from right to left, top to bottom. Each node in the plan is a specific operation that the relational engine carries out, possibly bringing in the storage engine to provide the row set data. If I hover over the icons in the plan, I can get more information about the cost of that particular step, in terms of I/O, CPU, number of rows affected, and so on. And if I access the Properties dialog through the context menu or via a double click, I get that and a little bit more information in the Properties pane. The execution plan also has some zooming options, as well as a little UI nugget in the bottom right corner that allows you to navigate the pane over an exceptionally large plan, where all the contents cannot fit in the current view. Now, for this specific query, you can see that the optimizer selected table scan. Given that the query returns the entire table, that makes sense, but in general, table scans are something you want to avoid, since they often indicate that a suitable index was not found for the query and a row-by-row search is required. Such row-by-row processing is definitely more expensive as the number of rows gets larger. Here's a second unqualified query. In this case, though, it's not a table scan, but an index scan. It's still a scan, though, so each row is being referenced. It's happening through an index this time, but the power of the index isn't really being leveraged here. Of course, it couldn't since there was no where clause. In the more general case, though, your takeaway should be that just because you see an index being used doesn't mean it's being used efficiently. Here, the scan is really the dominant action. Here's another one with a simple where clause, and the plan here proposes a clustered index seek. The clustered index here, there can only be one per table, is on the business entity ID, which seems an appropriate column given the uniqueness of that data. In fact, it's doing a seek here, which is a good thing. Because the rows are already sorted by the clustered index, there's no need to scan every row, either directly or via an index scan, so the seek can pick the rows much more efficiently. The next one is similar, but uses a where clause on a different column. And as you can see from the plan, we now have another index seek, but it's on a non-clustered index, the one composed of the last name and first name. The use of the seek here signals that we've got an appropriate index to optimize this type of query. Here's another one, almost identical to the one before, except I've pulled in another column into the select list. Let's see what happens. It looks quite a bit different. Now I've got the index seek from before, which makes sense because it's the same where clause as the last one, but it's combined with a key lookup and nested loops operator. The key lookup is required here to pull in the extra piece of information, the title, which is not covered by the existing index. Associated with the key lookup, always, is a nested loops operator, which essentially performs a join. Here it's joining data provided via the index, the first name and last name, with information provided by the key lookup, the title. Now the next query here is a bit more complex and pulls in four different tables to compute the result set. There's definitely a lot going on here. Remember, start from the top right and work your way down and left. I'll walk through it quickly here based on some offline analysis, but you can easily recreate this query yourself against the AdventureWorks 2008 database and more carefully analyze each step. The first clustered index scan accesses the employee table, specifically to fulfill the job title column in the select list. The clustered index seek below it is pulling out the business entity ID and the address ID from the person table. Now the nested loops inner join can match the business entity IDs and provide intermediate output that associates job titles with addresses via the business entity ID. The index scan below the nested loops join accumulates a list of cities, the second column in the result set, by address ID. That subset is then joined with the output of the nested loops above it via a hash match join. Hash matches are the most complex of the three join types, and in this case it's probing the results of the index scan to create the correlation between business entity ID and city via the address ID. Note, through previous operations, business entity ID and job title were already correlated, so now city is added to the mix. The clustered index seek at the bottom pulls in the remaining select columns, last name and first name, and the next nested loops join brings all the pieces together, again using business entity ID as the link. Finishing off the query is a scalar operation, which performs the string concatenation between last name and first name in the select clause. And then the final select on the far left is the plan's terminating node. This query is certainly more interesting and actionable than the others I've shown so far. Below the nodes, you can see what each operation contributes to the overall cost of the query. And as with any tuning exercise, you typically want to start with the operation taking the longest. That happens to be the bottommost clustered index seek, which delivers the last name and first name columns in the query. It's unlikely you can tune that part of it, though, since it's already doing the most efficient operation it can to meet the requirements. The index scan to pull in the city is the second most expensive, and it is indeed a scan versus a seek, so there is a potential for improvement there. Looking at the select node quickly, make a mental note of the fact that this entire plan has a subtree cost of 0.565182. Now to experiment. I'll add a new index to the address table on just the city column, and let's see what happens. The result set still includes an index scan, but notice how the percentage of contribution to the overall cost has dropped significantly. The subtree cost of the query is now 0.460738, about 20% cheaper. While it's pretty cool to see how you can measure the outcome of excursions like this, I didn't do nearly enough analysis to make a final decision on whether or not I should add this new index. Indexes have overhead, especially when a table has a lot of inserts and deletes. So depending on the nature of the application, I could be making an improvement here, but negatively impacting another more heavily used part of my application. Within your own sandbox, though, you can see it's pretty easy to experiment, gain a clearer understanding of what makes your queries tick, and perhaps better leverage the database design that you are working with. Let's head back to the slides now. In the simple plans we looked at, we covered a few of the operators that you might encounter. All totaled, there are 78 different execution plan operators, so it's pretty clear we only scratched the surface in what we did here. MSDN has documentation on each of those operators, should you want to read more about them. There are a few common hotspots to look out for, though, and we saw a number of these during the demo. Let me preface the next two slides by mentioning the comments that I'll make are generalizations. In most cases, the query optimizer will do the right thing, even if the decisions seem counterintuitive to you, since it's pulling in a number of different variables to arrive at the plan. Keeping my generalization caveat in mind, when you see a scan in an execution plan, it may indicate a potential for improvement, possibly through the addition of an index. Table scans are the worst, but index scans still involve looking at information row by row to determine the result set. Seeks in general are a good thing because they indicate that an index is being used. Be aware, though, of the law of diminishing returns. In some cases, like when a table contains a small number of rows, a full scan can actually be more efficient than using an index, which involves a level of indirection. So don't be surprised if the plan opts for scans in such cases. If you see a key lookup, you'll also see a nested loop, which is a join construct. The key lookup can indicate that an index you have declared isn't inclusive enough. For instance, maybe it should include another column as part of that index. Curses in general tend to be overused. Versus cycling through rows, it's generally advised to use set-based constructs of SQL to get better performance. If cursors are indeed the appropriate implementation for your task, you might consider using SQL CLR procedures to implement the logic, since they often perform better than the T-SQL alternative. In your plans, you may see multiple different types of operators that perform joins. Each of these operators has a specific area in which it excels over the other. For instance, a hash match is often used if you are joining tables that have a significant difference in the number of rows. Hash matches are also used for ad hoc queries, since the columns specified in the join may not be indexed. Merge joins tend to be employed for moderately sized tables, and when a unique column is involved in the join. Merges also require indexed or sorted data, so the presence of an order by can increase the probability of their use. A nested loop is typically used for simpler joins and involves iterating over rows in one table and looking for matches in the other. Thus, an index on the join columns is key to performance. That's 11 of the 78 operators, the ones as developers you're likely the most interested in, and I'm going to leave the other 67 as an exercise to you viewers. As you might expect, though, the ubiquitous 80-20 rule applies here as well. 20% of the operators will be used 80% of the time. On to the do's and don'ts to close out this session. There's a lot of information that you can glean from these plans, and a lot of questions that get raised in the process. Retain your focus and concentrate on the queries that matter. You might also consider retaining execution plans. One option is to save them as XML. With retained execution plans, you can provide for better trend analysis as your application matures or the data footprint changes. Lastly, this is another great opportunity to experiment. Generally, the query optimizer knows best, but you can override it for specific queries with hints, which, even if they don't lead to better performance, provide an opportunity to gain more insight into how things are working under the covers. Don't forget to make sure statistics are updated, since they are a key piece of information used to formulate the estimated execution plans. If there are significant changes to the data profile, for instance, you've added or deleted a large amount of data, a call to update statistics is a good idea. My second note here, don't obsess, is a direct result of becoming mesmerized myself and even the simple examples I worked with to prepare this presentation. It's pretty easy and fun in a geeky sort of way to dive in really deep here, but that's not always the most productive thing to do in terms of meeting your application requirements and deadlines. In each of my sessions, I've provided a set of links in the bottom right corner, and this time I'd like to call attention to the last one here in particular. It's a pointer to an ebook entitled SQL Server Execution Plans by Grant Fritchie, a SQL Server MVP and leader of the Southern New England SQL Server User Group. It's a very readable reference for navigating execution plans, with great examples illustrating the various concepts. The book is free in PDF form, but you can also purchase a hard copy from outlets like Amazon. And with that, I'll close out this series on SQL Server for Developers. I hope you found it a useful introduction to concepts into which we as developers don't often get the chance to delve further. Thanks for joining me, and have a great rest of your day.